Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily on Wednesday, the 7th of May. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up on the show.
I think it was just the buzz of going every week and finding out if you're up or you're down. Like standing on the scale, having a good week, then going to the chipper on the way home.
And he just was like, your mom's died suddenly. And she was only 53, and you know, she did yoga and everything like that. We never really saw it coming. Like, she was the epitome of health. And I remember even when it happened, I smashed my phone on the ground.
Well, I think like Catholics everywhere, we're hoping that the Cardinals pick someone who's holy, who is a good evangelizer, and who is also a good manager too. And those are three difficult things to find in one person.
Comedian Aoife Dunn was Oliver Callan's guest today, a newcomer to the comedy scene. Her new show is called Good Grief.
Aoife Dunn, welcome.
Thanks so much.
You're a Galway woman.
I am indeed.
And how long have you been performing now in the comedy circuit?
I've only been doing it now a year and a half.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a relative latecomer. But you've dreamt of this all your life.
I have, yeah.
How badly have you been dreaming about it?
So I always tell the story of when I was supposed to be Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Okay. And I was 14 years of age. And one of the girls in the class, Sarah Jane, she was trying to steal the part from me. And I was like, no, this has to be mine. And then I got the part. It was all going well until my arches fell on my feet. Did you know this is possible?
I hear about it, but
yeah,
it's not something
I'm
you've ever looked
I'm 5'1".
Up.
And all of a sudden, God was like, you're going to be smaller.
That is cruel.
So then they were like, well, if
it's
you can't...
It's very painful, by the way.
Oh, it's extremely painful. So I couldn't walk in Dorothy's shoes. I was 14 years of age and my whole life, I could see my Oscar fading in the
distance. Shoes are kind of important, aren't
important.
They?
Important. So my mom, she did what she normally did. She put like these high heel shoes on. She painted them red. She strapped my feet into them. And I walked into the community centre that day and I was like, Sarah Jane, this will be mine. I have to be Dorothy. I looked deranged, like with these painful feet moving onto the stage. But I think I knew then, like, this has to be, this is my dream.
You needed to be on a stage somehow,
absolutely,
somewhere. That was
absolutely
what you were going to do. Did you ever get to play Dorothy ever since?
No, that was my only in the community centre in Kinvara. But still, the highlight of my career, Oliver.
God, you know, you're after reminding me. I said Kinvara was in Clare last week and the amount of texts we got.
Oh, but a lot of people think it is on the border.
It's on
in
the
fairness.
Road, you see, isn't it? Coming out of the burn.
Yes,
that's
very good.
But Kinvara's the one with the giant thatch. Is that a hotel that's entirely thatched?
Yes, yes.
It
yes,
is?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go, sir. So apologies to everyone in Kinvara, but you're putting it in the map anyway.
Yes.
One comedy show at a time.
Exactly.
What were you? What's the response, by the way? A year and a half of comedy, what kind yes. of, what are people saying to you?
I think a lot of the comedians who've been at it a while hate me, but... I think people are maybe, I suppose people in the comedy scene are maybe, you know, shocked that it's moving so fast for me.
It is.
But then people who know me, they're not surprised because they're like, this is what you were born to do your whole life. And a part of me thinks like, I suppose I've been waiting, even though I haven't performed, I haven't been on stage. The last time I was on stage was when I was 19 years of age. Mm-hmm. And I went to London to do this. We had won this competition, me and my theatre group. So we went to the National Theatre of London. I was like, this is it. This is the beginning of my dreams. I told my mom, I was like, right, I'm in London. Bye. Good luck. Like, next stop is Broadway. You'll never see me ever again. And then when I got there afterwards, there was all these like young girls there and they were around the same age. And they kept asking me like, what school do you study at? Do you study at RADA? And I started looking at their clothes and I was like, oh my God, these are rich girls.
Oh no.
And I have everyone around me. And the thing is, when you grow up in Kinvara or Galway, there's no such thing as class. So I didn't
really?
Realize. Yeah, I didn't realize there was such a thing as like poor people and rich people. And for the first time in my life at 19, I was like, oh my God, if you want to be an actress, you need to be rich and you need to have like parents in the arts. And my mom was a single mom and we were from like, you know, poor background. And I looked at these girls, I looked at my clothes and I was like, this isn't for me. And I came home and I hung up my...
That kind of killed your confidence.
Honestly,
it was...
Yeah, so it's like the first time I kind of came to terms with privilege and I was like, I felt so intimidated, so intimidated. I came home and I kind of bullied myself out of it. And when I think of her like at 19, I kind of get choked up even remembering this story because I'm thinking to myself, God, like the poor thing, like I think of me, younger me and she. Yeah, so I didn't go near the stage again until a year and a half ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Extraordinary story. Mm-hmm. You look fresh and young, but it's quite, that's a small bit of a distance. but some working class actors do make it
they
in
do.
London. I was thinking Jack Connell recently. I don't know if you've seen Sinners, that film.
Yes.
Really well.
Brilliant. Yes, yes, yes.
He's like the one who broke through all the posh
yes.
Benedict
and Barry
Cumberbatches
Keoghan as
and
well.
All that.
And yeah. Yeah.
But particularly in the London scene.
In the London scene.
Especially.
Yes.
Especially difficult. Okay, so, by the way, did you train alongside Nicola Coughlan? Is that something
yes.
you've made up for comedy purposes?
No. Poor really Nicola, she gets used in my comedy show.
Oh, good.
As the one who made it. So, yeah, we did drama together since we were both 11 years of age. So we used to
really?
Go in. Yeah, Mom used to drive us in and we take it in turns because she lives in Oranmore, so not too far. And we go in every Saturday morning and, from ages 11 till we were about like 18, 19. And the thing is, when I was 19, that's when I gave up. But she just had this like fire in her belly to keep going. But yeah, I make a joke in the show that like, you know, I'm at home taking care of my brothers and drive my brother to, you know, to tan his body when he became a bodybuilder. And I'm just thinking, and then I'm looking at my phone and Nicola's in Bridgerton. I was like, okay, I'm just putting tan on my brother's body while Nicola Coughlin's in
Bridgerton. We were together at
yes.
the same time.
Hey, this wasn't the plan.
Bridgerton, Derry Girls,
yes.
and Kim Kardashian's fast fashion brand.
Yes.
That's the dream, isn't
That's
it?
That's the dream.
That's what we all would do. We'd all sell out, I swear. Nicola, she was obviously lovely growing up.
You're not she was. Anything. Imagine if I was about to give you the inside scoop. No, she's actually...
But a good row would help you know,
wouldn't
drive
it?
Sales.
I'm like, okay, I'll go. I'll give you it.
Me
she
together.
Was horrible. No, she wasn't. She's the nicest person in the world.
Do you stay in touch? Is that
yeah,
possible
yeah,
in
yeah.
her world?
Yeah, she's amazing. She's still like so humble and like brings her friends to everything. Like when Bridgerton had their red carpet event here recently, she invited me. I actually had to say no. I had to turn her down.
What?
I was like, I've got my own thing going on, Nicola.
Okay, you have to show up for,
yeah,
your, for
I'm busy.
Your stage work.
Yeah, I've Absolutely. Got 30 people coming to my show. I can't.
It is called Good Grief.
Yes.
Like I said, sorry, I don't know if you could hear because you were putting on your headphones, but do you kind of go, Good Grief? Or do you go, Good Grief?
Very good.
What's your
good,
tone?
Good Grief.
Good Grief. you were backpacking at the age of 23.
Yes.
Around Bolivia, which sounds like beautiful.
Yes.
This is around 2010, isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
Ireland was not a very pleasant place mm-hmm. to be. And you get the worst news imaginable.
Yeah, because obviously we just hit recession right back in Ireland. So I did what every young 23-year-old wants to do when she's yeah. Irish. And I just like, right, I'm going to go travel the world. And so we started in Argentina and we were traveling about 2 months. And it was going great. Met loads of lovely Argentinian boys. Perfect. And then we were just about an hour from the Bolivia border and my phone rang. And I knew it was Mum because she was the only one who had my phone number.
Right.
And it was one of those old burner phones. So I picked up and I was like, Mummy, because I hadn't talked to her in 2 weeks and mm-hmm. we were best friends. So I was so excited to fill her in on everything. And then I heard a man's voice on the other side. And it's so bad, but I remember hating this guy for so long just for saying these words. And he just was like, your mom's died suddenly. And she was only 53 and, you know, she did yoga and everything like that. We never really saw it coming. Like she was the epitome of health. And I remember even when it happened, I smashed my phone on the ground and I couldn't speak for a second. I think I hoped that I would just like break time
yeah.
and that I would just, none of this had to be real. I didn't even tell my friend, like the bus kept driving and for a few minutes I didn't speak. And my friend was sat there. She was like laughing with some people behind us. And she was like, what happened? And I was so afraid to say it in case I made it even more real. But then one of my best friends from home called me and called my other friend. And that was it. Yeah.
That bus journey must go through your head
yeah.
over and over.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was really, really difficult. Thank God I say like we didn't make it to Bolivia because my phone wouldn't have worked. So we were only, yeah, an
Isn't
hour
that extraordinary?
From the border. Yeah. An hour from the border and she wouldn't have been able to contact me for like 4 days. So I don't know how I would have made it home for the funeral. So, and then after that, everything is kind of a haze. Like it took days to get home, but like the local community, my family, everybody got together and paid for everything, organized everything, booked everything.
You remember the journey home though, don't you?
Which 100%.
Which is incredible because most people, as I say, go into the haze and it's a blur. But you remember very mm-hmm. kind of visceral moments,
yes.
particularly when you get to Dublin airport.
Yeah. So like I remember we were stranded in Paris for hours because it was the winter of the big freeze. So all of Europe was just blanketed in
yeah.
snow. And
yeah.
I remember I was crying so much that I was embarrassed because people around were excited to come home for Christmas, mm-hmm. right? There was
yeah.
loads of girls back from Australia and there was a man there and I think he had seen me and he got on the plane. He was actually sat next to me and he started talking to me to kind of distract me. And he had this kind of American accent, so we assumed he was from America. And he was like, hey, guys, I'm from Dublin, but I've been in Boston for 20 years. Do I sound American? I was like, you do. You really do. And then as I got off the plane, he pulled my hand and he gave me a big hug and he said, whatever you're going home to, I promise it gets better.
So he knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah, he knew. He missed the scene, or maybe he's been there himself.
He just did the nice distraction thing.
That's it. And there was so many people, like on the airplane, people made sure that I had a whole seat to myself at the back. And like the air hostesses gave me like chocolates. And I met the nicest of people, because they say like in the worst of times, the best of people come out. And when I got to the airport, my best friends had made that treacherous journey in the winter of the big freeze all the way from Galway to Dublin just to carry me home, basically.
Wow.
Yeah.
You never saw or heard from that man again, did you?
No, I sometimes, yeah, I was like, what? I need to find him. And, you know I have a boyfriend now, but maybe this is a really cute.
But these angels kind of appear, don't they?
100%.
To help you along.
Oh, no, it was like, I say to people, like, it was the worst time of my life, but I saw the most incredible form of humanity. Like, even when we came down to the small road down to my house, I was in the car with my friends and I closed my eyes because this was the road that I used to take going down to see my mum after school. Okay. And so many memories came flooding back and it was almost too intense. So I closed my eyes and it was dark, it was cold. And my friends stirred me. They're like, you have to see this. And all the houses, all these sort of local neighbours, they'd put candles on the wall to guide me. Yeah, just to guide me home. So to make it a little easier.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
I know, it was beautiful, beautiful.
We're loving Kinvara more and more, by the way.
Honestly.
What were your plans in life at 23 before that news?
So I was like, I was going to do a human rights master's. I had signed up to do that. And that was going to be my life. I was going to travel the world. And then, I mean, I think I always thought maybe I go back to acting at some point.
Yeah.
But then when mom died, my brother was still in school.
It's a single parent household. Before
a single parent household. Now, exactly.
You're the head of the household.
Exactly. Yeah.
At 23.
Yeah. And I couldn't cook to save my life.
So two younger brothers.
Yes, I have two younger brothers and my sister's a year older, but she has an intellectual disability. So it kind of fell on me to, yeah, I suppose, take the helm of the ship. And one of my brothers was in college, but the other was only doing his leave insert.
Right, so he's living at home.
Yeah, so getting up, getting him off to school, making lunches, cooking his dinner, doing a bit of grinds to make a bit of money because we had no money coming in as well. And then our local community, they set up a charity for us.
Yeah.
To make sure that my brothers could get to college.
That's like, amazing,
isn't it? We never asked for any of this. They came, they're like, you've no say, we're doing this for you. And they had it all like legally above board. They had board members and everything like that. So then when my brothers got through to college, it stopped. But
is there no council fund or state grant for homes like that? Obviously your brother being school still was a dependent.
Yeah, so they're technically orphans under the law. So yeah. I applied for this welfare for orphans, for the two of them. And they said, no, because your dad's still alive, even though he wasn't supporting. And I appealed and appealed and they kept saying no. So I wrote a letter basically saying I'm going to go public with this. And these two children were left orphaned using my human rights, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I got a call from the Department of Welfare, the head, apologising profusely and backdating the payment. So,
The battle was won.
And that was the beginning of... me realising my power.
During the battle, it was the community paid the bills,
kept things together.
Wow, amazing story.
We wouldn't have, I honestly don't think I'd be here without the support of our local community. I don't know how the four of us, because we're all doing amazingly now, you know, and it's like we were orphaned, there was no money, mom was incredibly in debt, and to be where we all are now, like it's just thanks to the local people, honestly.
Comedian Aoife Dunn chatting to Oliver Callan today. To look ahead to some of the best TV and cinema releases for the month ahead, Claire Byrne was joined by producer and director Brian Redden and freelance journalist Aoife Barry.
Hacks is back on Now TV. You really like this, Aoife.
I love this. And I'm just always trying to encourage people to watch Hacks because I think it kind of flies a little bit under the radar in Ireland. Like in America, it's won Emmys. You know, people are huge, big fans of the two stars in it. Jean Smart, who is an icon, and Hannah Einbender, who is like a young, soon to be icon, amazing comedian. And they play a really great like team of women. So basically the plot behind it is that Ava Daniels is this, she's played by Hannah Einbender, is this young upstart comedian who who gets kind of kicked out of her job because she says some bad stuff on Twitter. And she ends up being the assistant to Deborah Vance, who is this kind of Las Vegas queen, this longtime comedian who's got a long reputation, but maybe a little bit old in the tooth. And the idea is that Ava is going to help Deborah get her career back up to scratch. And this is the fourth season. And you would think, how does, a series in these days go to four seasons, still be worth watching, not kind of be scraping the bottom of the barrel? And it's because it's got brilliant writing. The dynamic between the two women goes from, friends to enemies constantly, but in a very understandable way. They're not characters that you're going to fall in love with instantly. They both have their issues, but they're really, really funny. It's really short. There's only like 25 minutes per episode. The seasons are compact. And now we're on season four. They've got to the point where Deborah has her dream, which is a late night TV show. And Ava basically blackmails her to get the role as her lead writer on the show. So the two of them are at loggerheads, but need each other to survive in the cutthroat world of the Hollywood industry. So if you haven't watched it,
sold that very well. I think I watched season one and I've lost track of it. So I've got to go back now and watch two and three, and then we're on to four. But you're a fan as well, Brian, aren't you?
I love it. Jean Smart, it's just so good in it. And Jean Smart, an actress who's been around for a long time and plays, always kind of played smaller parts in bigger movies. She really shines in this. She's essentially playing Joan Rivers.
Yeah,
that's
essentially,
who she is.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that kind of a character. But what I like about it is, people always say about Seinfeld, Seinfeld's mantra was always, which is one of my favourite sitcoms of all time, its mantra was always, no lessons, no hugs.
Mm.
And this is very much like that. As you were saying, in this season, the two of them like each other, but they also hate each other, right? And in this season, you don't get a warm, huggy feeling at the end of every episode.
No, you don't. And in fact, when you do, they flip the script on you constantly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Deborah character, she's horrible and she does horrible things.
Yeah.
And she's just mean and she's nasty. And you shouldn't like her. But inside there's a really nice person trying to get out, but she won't let it out. And every time she almost does, she just reverts back to being this horrible, horrible woman.
But she's been made coarse by the career.
Well, that's it.
Definitely. It's a lot of gender and age stuff that's discussed here. This idea of that she had to kick and scream her way through her career. And, then Ava arrives standing on the shoulders of the women who have created comedy to be a place where, certainly not equal, but where women can have big roles. And Ava's like, hang on, just get with the programme. And Deborah Vance is saying, well, hang on, I had to really push to get here and you better take it seriously. So it really, interrogates. So it's been a really funny way. Some of the lines in it will have you hooting, laughing.
A lot of the characters around her, her agent is very funny. The agent's assistant is also her co-agent. Now, they're all very well-written characters and they're very funny. And it's, as you say, it's a nice short little episode. It's 24, 25 minutes. And it's on Now TV. I think T.G. Carr have the first couple of seasons of it now as well. It was hard to find it for a long time.
Season three took ages to get to the screen. So now that we have season four in Ireland, get watching it, become a big Hacks fan like us.
The next one we're going to talk about, Poker Face, has a similar kind of vibe, and it's been really heavily promoted because the cast this season is very starry, isn't it?
It really is. And I mean, the main person is Natasha Lyonne, and I just love watching her on screen. In a way, she kind of plays the same character. She's in Russian Doll, and one of my favourite series of the last kind of 10 years or so. She's, everything she's in, Orange is the New Black, she's this kind of, gritty woman with this really cool New York accent. And in this, she plays a person called Charlie Cale, who, in kind of like a Columbo idea, she solves crimes in every episode and the viewer knows what has happened at the start of it. So just in Columbo, you see the murder happen and then you see her trying to unravel it. And Charlie has this particular skill where she can understand if somebody is lying to her, but she doesn't know what the truth is. So she's trying to unravel a different mystery in each one. And what's interesting in this season is they've really ramped up the caliber of the guest stars, and they were pretty amazing in series one. So you've got, Cynthia Erivo, who plays Quintuplets. So she's got five roles there. Melanie Lynskey, you've got Rhea Perlman is in it as well, Camille Nanjiani. And the idea as well too is that we've got Rian Johnson, who is from Star Wars, Glass Onion, for example. He is a director, he's an executive producer on this, but he's a director who loves the old school kind of mystery. He loves the golden age of mystery. He loves the 70s mystery style TV shows. So he's got that influence on it where it looks great, the characters are great, and you're really with Natasha Lyonne's character as she's trying to unravel it all and kind of get her life back on track, because she's a bit of kind of wasting her life in many ways. But and also her whoever does the costumes, the clothes in it are fantastic. So
and nice short-ish episodes as well.
Short, they can go up to an hour, but they don't overstay their welcome, I'll say that much, because you've got the setup of the initial murder and then you have the kind of solution, to the murder. So you've got two parts in a way to each.
Duration's important when you're getting up early in the morning. You want something in bite-sized chunks,
exactly,
which is what we have now in the next one. one, yeah. The Four Seasons, which yeah. I'm watching at the moment. I have one more episode to go. I've just yeah. devoured it because it's great crack.
It is. I love it. Mm. It's number one on Netflix now, stream at the moment. So it's eight half-hour episodes. It's getting kind of mixed reviews, but I mean, I'd be on the positive side of it. I really enjoyed it. First of all, I enjoyed the movie it was based on. So the movie way back in 1981, I remember that when Alan Alda brought that out. So Alan Alda, who also makes an appearance in this, wrote and directed a film called The Four Seasons, roughly based on The Four Seasons. And they use Vivaldi's music all the way throughout it. That's where it gets the name from. And the basic premise is that three married couples have known each other since they were in high school together, or college together rather, go on vacation and they all love each other and they're all great mates and all that. And then one of the couples break up and get divorced, and the husband brings along a much younger girl, and that upsets the balance and the dynamic mm-hmm. in the group. That's what the original film was all about. The series is exactly the same thing, with one major difference that we won't give away because it's a major spoiler. but apart from that major, they've updated it a little bit. One of the couples is now gay, which wasn't the case in the original. But essentially, you've got these three couples, all known each other for a very long time. Steve Carell's character decides he's going to divorce his wife, and he brings a young girl into the mix. And then what you have then is a kind of a comedy of errors, really, where the couples are kind of reassess their own relationships. The guys are jealous of this young woman in this guy's life. He's living his just brand new life. Mm. But then who do you side with? Do you side with the husband? Do you side with the wife? The wife that he has left has now been left out of the group. They want to bring her back in. So there's all this going on. But it's really interesting. And I like it a lot. It's, I mean, because all the characters in it are in their mid-50s and been married for 25 years. And a lot of it is about how marriage just becomes, not that you get into a rut in it, but that you become so familiar with each other that maybe, you know, where this guy's bringing in this young girl, it's all romantic and it's exciting and it's in this honeymoon period. They don't have that anymore. They've settled into an ordinary kind of zone. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that's okay. Sometimes that's what marriage and love and life is all about. So that's kind of the theme of the whole thing. Yeah. And I kind of like that.
I enjoyed it. I mean, you were saying earlier, no hugs and no lessons. There are a few hugs and a few lessons in it, and you have to sort of get past that. It can be a little bit icky at times.
Yeah.
But it's a good watch, I found it.
It is. And like Tina Fey, I find Tina Fey kind of hit and miss. Like, I loved 30 Rock, the best thing she's ever done. Since then, I haven't been a huge fan of hers. And she can be a bit schmaltzy and she can be a bit silly, and the humour can be a bit silly. But I think she nails it with this. As you say, there is a bit of schmaltz in it, absolutely. But, you know, if you open yourself up to that and just sit back and relax and enjoy it, I think you'll really, really go with it.
Who's the actor who plays her husband in this?
Will Forte.
That's Will Forte.
Yeah, he's usually just a comedian.
Again,
so
but they're mostly comedians.
Yeah.
But the original film was that too, because the original film had Alan Alda, known for MASH, and Carol Burnett, also a comedian. So it's interesting that they've gone. So you've got, you know, Will Forte, Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey and Steve Carell, all comics, playing very serious roles. But the guy who steals it is Coleman Domingo.
He's just so amazing, good. I'm not as big a fan of the series as the two of you. I have to say, my mom watched it and we kept looking at each other towards the like fifth and sixth episode saying, what is happening? But Coleman Domingo and his amazing wardrobe and his kind of joie de vivre. And he also directs at least one episode of it too.
So I think
so he's a really good reason to watch it. But I do think Tina Fey isn't on her best form writing-wise in it. I'm sorry. I think some of the jokes should have been worked out better, but I'm not Tina Fey, so
I just enjoyed. Sometimes you have a shot of the six of them reacting to an event, and it's always Will Forte's face that I'm attracted to.
Yeah.
He doesn't
have
to say anything, he just gets it. He's incredible.
And you kind of have to buy into that. So, I mean, they go on holiday, they go on vacation four times a year together to the most amazing locations.
And he's a teacher, and you're kind of going, how's
he affording that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, once you get
country,
over that,
none of them's a freelancer, definitely.
No, definitely not. So, once you get over that, but it's good, it's very watchable. And the thing about it is, you know, you'll sit down and watch one episode, you'd be five in before you know it.
I know,
they're quick.
And it's number one on Netflix. That's The Four Seasons. If you haven't caught up with that, worth doing it now. A new Netflix series, Forever. This is inspired by Judy Blume's book from 1975 for young adults. What's going on here?
50 years old. And you know, this book, if anybody, I mean, I think most people, you know, the teenage girls growing up to probably the late 90s, early 2000s, were handed the Judy Blume books. Even now, probably handed them, because they were always capturing a moment in time for teenagers and what it was like to fall in love and to have relationships. And even though they're very much of their time, they were, you know, particularly kind of books that were very precious, I think, to young girls. When I was growing up, Forever was the one that was the kind of more adult books. It was definitely going from the teenage kind of crushes to something a lot more serious. And it's a book that's been on many lists in America in terms of being challenged in school libraries, which is kind of ridiculous because it's a very kind of basic book, but it is a bit more of a risque read. And now we finally have a TV version of this. It's going to be a series starring Lovie Simone and Michael Cooper Jr. not hugely well-known kind of young actors. The two teenagers, they become each other's first love, and we follow their journey, kind of, you know, the back and forth of what it's like to be young, be a teenager, to fall in love, to, you know, not know if the person loves you, to deal with all of these adult questions that come with it. Judy Blume's an executive producer. I think that's a good sign that you get the kind of sign-off. It's very much updated. It's set in 2018, I think, in Los Angeles. So you've got more of that modern take, and, you know, they have iPhones. They're not going to be obsessed with the same minutiae of things that people were back in the mid-70s. So yeah, it'll be really interesting, probably for your younger viewers, I would think. Maybe adults might find they're a little bit too old for it. But, you know, Judy Blume is having a renaissance, and I think, you know, there was a documentary about her, you know, a couple of years ago. There was also a remake of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, or a film version of that book. So I think, you know, she's having a renaissance, and I think her core message of, like, understanding teenagers and, you know, being empathic towards them is a lovely one we can still carry through
today. That's out tomorrow on
the 8th of May, exactly, Netflix. Tomorrow on
it's
Netflix.
Called Forever on Netflix. Brian, you're next one. I don't know if I can watch this. This is Netflix again. Yeah. It's a documentary series on Fred and Rosemary West.
Yes, I recommend this with caution because, you know, Netflix do these true crime things really well. So if you like them, I think you'll probably like this one. It's on May 14th on Netflix, and it's called Fred and Rose West, A British Horror Story. And it is a horror story. I was reading the background to it, and I remember the story, and I remember, you know, all the revelations about it, but it is pretty grim. It's pretty grim watching and pretty grim reading. But I think what's interesting about this, so, I mean, for people who don't know, they're Britain's most prolific serial killers. They were a married couple who, between the years of 1967 and 1987, murdered 12 young women and buried them in their garden and under the basement in the house. And of course, both of them were eventually caught. He killed himself in prison. She's still in prison to this day. So there's been movies made about these guys. There's been lots of documentaries made about them. So you'd think, what else is there to say? But what I think was interesting about this, and they were horrific monsters. I mean, from the abuse they get to their own family to complete strangers, it would be very difficult to watch. Except this, I believe, is told from the point of view of the families of the victims. So like, quite often the 12 people who were murdered get overlooked, and Fred and West are glamorised a little bit. Not quite glamorised, but you know what I mean. In this case, they're looking at the families of the victims for the very first time get a chance to speak up. So you kind of understand who they were, and it kind of, you know, basically you get to understand,
so,
and you get to know who the victims
were. Really,
so for that, and also apparently they've introduced, they have all these audio recordings from the original interviews with the two killers, and they have the footage of the initial investigation that has never been seen before. Everybody always says they've got something that's never been seen and never been heard before, but it seems to be the case in this. But I think they've taken it from the point of view of the families of the victims, and that's different. So it's not glamorising these two evil, horrible people, and it's only three parts, so it'll be a difficult watch, but I think it'll be kind of fascinating.
Okay, that's out on the 14th of May on Netflix. And then finally, Aoife, a word for The Surfer, which is directed by Lorcan Finnegan. Our own Lorcan Finnegan.
Exactly. Irish director. People will know his films like Vivarium, Nocebo, Without Name. And this one's really interesting because he's got Nicolas Cage as the star of the film, which is a real coup for an Irish director. And it was also filmed in Australia. Basically, Nicolas Cage plays a man who goes to the childhood beach that he used to surf on when he was a young kid. Goes there to surf with his son, but he's humiliated by a group of locals. Anybody who's seen Nicolas Cage in any film will know that he's a man who's very kind of intense when it comes to his role. So you can imagine the reaction of this character. He's drawn into this big conflict. It pushes him to breaking point. I've seen little clips of it, and it's really Nick Cage in fine form. And it was described as a gloriously demented B-movie thriller by The Guardian. So people might have seen it at some film festivals recently. I think it was on at DIFF, but it's in the cinemas from the 9th of May.
Producer and director Brian Redden and journalist Aoife Barry on Today with Claire Byrne, and some great recommendations there for whenever the weather does get back to normal. Vet Niamh Fagan joined Claire Byrne to answer listeners' questions, and today's topic was itchy pets.
We'll start with the dogs. What are the main causes for itching in dogs?
Yes, so main causes, allergies is a big one. We've been through that before. Allergies, and then also parasites, especially around this time of the year. Burdens are much higher. So we would see fleas, mites. They'd be a big cause of itching.
What about ticks? We were talking about ticks last week on the programme. They're probably an issue this time of the year as well.
They absolutely are. Yes, less so itching. It's more so you have to go looking for them. Really important as well to keep on top of an anti-parasitic treatment to make sure that ticks are, if they are attached, that they fall off and die. So anti-parasitic treatment is really, really important. preventative, not only just to treat when the infection actually starts.
So now is the time to do all of the flea treatments and all of that business.
Yeah, if you're doing it any time of the year, kind of early spring, right through to the end of summer is really, really important. Some products will last a month, some products will last 3 months. It's important to get a prescription product as well. That's what I would advise. A lot of the time I would get dogs and cats in maybe with a flea burden and the owner says, oh, I put a spot on them last week. But the spot on has been bought maybe from a local supermarket or a pet shop. These products aren't regulated and sometimes they're herbal products, things like that. So I advise a prescription product from your vet.
And they might work for some people and that's fine, but you're saying your standard is that you would get something on prescription to manage it, particularly at this time of the year. So when it comes to cats then, are there different reasons behind the itch in the cat?
So it's much the same, but the most common would be slightly different, I suppose. So with cats, we do have allergies. Flea allergy dermatitis is a big one. So it's not the physical fleas that are the issue, but more so when the flea bites the cat, the saliva causes an allergic reaction. And you can diagnose that. A strong sign of that is if you run your hand down your cat's back, there's a bumpy kind of texture to the skin and they're scratching a lot as well. So
sounds really irritating for the poor cat.
It's really uncomfortable. So they'll need treatment for the skin and then to treat the underlying flea problem as well.
Okay, so you'll have to deal with two problems there. Well, listen, questions coming in. This one about a cockapoo from Josephine. The cockapoo is well-groomed but constantly scratching. I can't see anything on his skin and he gets a monthly tablet for parasites and fleas.
Mm-hmm. So you've covered the flea burden there, the parasite burden. Cockapoos are actually prone to having allergies. So what the allergy is, you know, I can't tell you as to whether maybe it is a food, maybe it's an environmental allergy. Is this something that happens just in the summer months? Is it pollen, grass, that kind of thing? Or is it all year long? And if it's all year long, we might need to go down a food route. Again, speaking to your vet and getting a prescription diet and trialling that.
But can you test to see what's causing the allergy?
You can to a certain degree. How reliable they are is not 100% certain. You can get bloods done. And again, your vet can go through that. You can get bloods done for environmental allergies, but not for food allergies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you are going to have to, if you have a dog or a cat that's constantly itching, you're going to have to try and rule things out to see what's causing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes you do never get to the bottom of it and it's treatment because you can't leave the dog or cat scratching. It's, you know, it's miserable life to be living if they're itching all the time. But it's narrowing it down and breaking it down that way. But again, a good diary, a good history of what's been happening, how often is it happening and what has that dog or cat been exposed to is really important. If you bring that to your vet, they'll have all the information there and they can kind of start off on a good foot then.
Mm-hmm. But to treat the itch initially, are you talking steroids?
So steroids are an option. There is alternatives, maybe safer alternatives, especially for younger, healthier dogs. We don't want to be giving steroids all the time to them. So there is multiple options there. And there's other injections and tablets that they can get.
Okay, this listener has a dog with recurring ear infections and the dog has been started on a medication called Apoquel. Does that prevent the ear infection, they want to know?
So that prevents the allergy. So you get an allergy and you'll then get inflammation. With inflammation comes an infection and that's where the infections are reoccurring. So it's treating the underlying issue, which is the allergy. And that's why Apoquel has been prescribed.
Right, for that animal. Right. Mm-hmm. This is a 10-year-old golden retriever who constantly gets a skin allergy, which is flared up really bad at the moment. I constantly get antibiotics and a skin scrub for him. Is it from the grass? It tends to flare up from wet grass, they think.
It could be. Grass is a common allergen for dogs. So it could be. And how do you control that? This is a common case of we can't actually control that allergen. We need to manage the symptoms and make sure the dog is comfortable. So the treatment that's been prescribed and just trying to get on top of it before the allergy gets really bad is really important.
So if somebody suspects it's a food allergy, what do you advise you rule out in those circumstances?
Yeah. So the most common causes of allergens with food is proteins. So chicken is really, really high on the list. Chicken, beef, pork and dairy is really high as well. So you can try rule it out yourself, but it is, you know, I've had clients come in and they've gone through 100 different foods. You need to be consistent, use it for a good couple of weeks. And my advice is to get a prescription diet as well. If you're going to do it, do it right the first time and kind of be as thorough as you can.
Can you get plant-based vegan food for dogs?
You can. Not advised, especially not for cats. There is an insect food you can get, which is what we call a novel protein. And this is actually quite successful. So they're getting the protein from insects, which they wouldn't have been exposed to before, and therefore we're not seeing an allergy. So that's another option.
I would imagine that's an expensive road to go down, is it, at the moment?
It can be, yeah. It depends on the brand of the food. You can always do your own research and see what's available online. But an insect food, if you can get it in, it depends on the brand, you know.
Yeah, fish wasn't on your allergen list. Is fish
okay? No, it can be. It can be an issue. Again, another source of protein. It's lower on the list compared to your chickens and beef, but it is there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This listener would like to know if there's a way to prevent the cat picking up ticks. The cat spends a lot of time sleeping in the garden.
Yeah,
sounds nice in itself.
It does. Sounds like a nice life. To prevent it, you can't, unless you're preventing the cat from roaming where he wants to roam, especially with cats. It's very difficult. The thing is to get on top of the anti-parasitic treatment. So treating him with a spot on monthly would be very important, because various diseases can be spread through ticks. And also, if he's prone to ticks, he's probably going to be prone to picking up fleas. So it's get on top of that. You don't want fleas coming into your house. And if you have multiple pets in the house as well, it's spreading between the pets.
Right. But you are going to have to pick those ticks out, even if you're doing the treatment.
Sometimes they will fall off and die themselves. Okay. I always say, if they're in an area where there is a high burden of ticks, you'll always want to be grooming your cat, you know, checking for them. But if you are treating the cat for ticks, they should die off.
Vet Niamh Fagan on Today with Claire Byrne. On yesterday's show, Oliver was chatting to author Florence Knapp, whose new book, The Names, is all about what's in a name and how it might determine your path in life. And a listener got in touch to share the story of his name. Here's Victor Ernest.
I was what I call myself, a war baby, i.e. I was conceived during the blackout.
Oh, yeah.
I was born late on the 7th of May, but
1945,
yeah. And back then they didn't know the sex of a baby before it was born.
Yeah.
So my parents might have had names in their head, but as I was born late in the day, I was named on the 8th of May, the VE day. So that's why I'm called Victor Ernest.
Oh, that's a good a reason as any. VE Day, Victor Ernest. And what's your last name?
Livingstone.
Victor Ernest Livingstone. That's
Livingstone.
Oh, Livingstone.
Not like David. No, David was living. He got it wrong. I'm Livingstone.
Livingstone. That's an amazing name. And were you born in Dublin, or where were you born?
No, I was born in Wexford Hospital.
Oh,
Wexford. And I was the fourth of four children, but I was born 5 years after my sister Hazel, who was also born in May. So I think it was the blackouts, and of course there was no TV or anything then.
There were merry times in some parts of the world.
Merry times, yeah.
The Livingstones.
And I was lucky.
go on, yeah.
I was lucky I shouldn't be saying lucky about the war, but that's, I wouldn't be here, I think, only for the war. So that's it. But
so
of course,
you're 80 years of age today.
I am. I'll be 80 later on in the day. Yes, I will.
You have the exact hour and everything.
Along with some other famous people you mentioned earlier.
We did, yeah. Well, happy birthday to you, Victor. The Livingstones, they came here. Where did they come from originally?
Well, I did have a genealogist check it out once, and it would appear we came from Scotland during the Ulster Plantation.
All right.
In the early 1600s, and we came to Cavan, and Cavan was one of the nine counties of Ulster at that time.
Of course, still is.
So, and then we migrated down to Wexford.
To the southeast. And what are your plans now for the birthday?
Oh, I'm being brought out by my good wife, Margot, and we particularly like fish. And we'll probably go out to Caviston's in Glastool.
Oh, lovely.
And then next week I'm being brought to Dunbrody House in Wexford.
Kevin Dundon's place.
Kevin Dundon's place, yeah.
Oh, you're having a week-long celebration. It's like VE Day for you.
Yeah, yeah. One of the people coming with us actually knows Kevin quite well. So we'll have a great celebration.
You've got an in there. And Margot has interesting heritage herself, I believe.
Well, yes, indeed. One of her uncles was also Victor Ernest.
And of the Bewley family. Was that the Bewley side or is that on your side?
No, on her side, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You've much to celebrate.
That's a big coincidence, yeah.
Yeah, two VEs by marriage.
Well, yes, but poor old Victor, he's gone on a good while now.
Well, listen, happy birthday to you, Victor Ernest Livingstone, and enjoy your various birthday celebrations. And to Margaret as well, good day to you. Law Breha Honadich.
As heard on Oliver Callan today, and you can listen back to the show in full on the RTE Radio app. More than 130 cardinals from across the world gathered in the Vatican today to begin the process of electing a new pontiff following the death of Pope Francis. RTE reporter Barry Lenehan was there and he spoke to Claire Byrne.
Yes, the atmosphere of the tension building all morning, Claire, as the faithful here queuing to get into St. Peter's Square from very early morning to watch a public broadcast of that Mass, the Proelegendo Romano Pontificate, as the College of the Cardinal Electors pray one final time ahead of this afternoon's ancient and centuries-old ritual of conclave. And quite literally what's going to happen here over the next 2 days or so is quite literally black or white as I look up to the temporary chimney atop the Sistine Chapel, first used for conclave in 1939. But then again, nothing about conclave is black or white, Claire, either. A world's most exclusive club, if you will. 133 cardinal electors to elect the new leader of 1.3 billion Catholics worldwide. No official candidates, if you will, either. Although one person mentioned as a potential papile, a potential pope, Cardinal Lopez Romero, based in Morocco, said if he thought he was going to become pontiff, he would run from Rome and not stop until he got to Sicily. And no official election campaign either, although the streets away to my left, the Borgia Pio, the restaurants there, lots of unofficial politicking over the last few days from cardinals trying to talk up those that they are favourable towards, and with many reported to be several factions within the College of Cardinals, those who wish to continue with the reforms of Pope Francis, those who wish a more conservative pope, and indeed those who wish one of their own from their own country, a push perhaps for an Italian pope. And with all that in mind, in the past few moments, the Dean of the College of Cardinals, Cardinal Battista Re, in his homily in St. Peter's Basilica, he implored on the cardinal electors that their only consideration should be the good of the church and the good of humanity, and they should put all personal considerations aside when they cast their vote for the 266th successor of St. Peter later this afternoon. But people from all over the world have gathered here in St. Peter's Square. I've been meeting them since early morning, starting with the prominent American Jesuit priest with Wexford connections, Father Jim Martin.
Well, I think like Catholics everywhere, we're hoping that the Cardinals pick someone who's holy, who is a good evangelizer, and who is also a good manager, too. And those are three difficult things to find in one person.
And in America, we see perhaps people maybe looking for a different style of papacy to Pope Francis. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's about half and half. I think, Francis had, I think, at his death, something like a 75% approval rating among American Catholics. So the group that is not in favor of him is pretty, is smaller, but it's pretty loud. But I think it's probably half and half.
And as a man of faith yourself, how would you feel going into the Sistine Chapel today?
You know, I think at this point, these are all men of prayer. They probably have a sense of who they want or a couple of candidates. So I don't think they're too stressed. I don't know. But, you know, trying to be open to the Holy Spirit, which is always a spiritual process of opening yourself and trying not to be too tied down to one way of looking at things.
I'm from the Philippines. I pray for the presence of the power of the Holy Spirit and from in heaven. I pray that may our Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle pray that to grace and blessing the whole world.
Luis Antonio Tagle, very popular in the Philippines.
Yes, because me our cardinal and very charisma and capable for Pope.
I want to be there praying. My feeling is this, just to get there, be with them, pray the Holy Spirit and whatever God wants, here we are.
What style of papacy are you looking for?
I'm the one who were very much in sync with Francesco. The Holy Spirit is very creative, more than I. So we're open. But I would like someone that could go along whatever he started at the church, an open church.
This is a special day for you.
Special. For me, in this moment, it's important to be here. I'm the church, I'm part of the church, and that's what I'm looking for.
We plan to come here before the conclave, so just by chance we're here, so, you know, just trying to get immersed in the whole thing, so enjoying ourselves, you know. To the announcement, it's 9 to 7 o'clock, you know, so we come back for that. Okay.
And have you an interest in who might become the next pontiff?
Really don't know the candidates, but just curious to see who it will be, and hope he's good as the last pope.
I am from Austria, from Styria, and I'm waiting to the new pope. Like to see the new pope. History is it.
We had hoped to see Pope Francis because we have so much respect for all of the good things that he's done, and we feel he was the most progressive pope. We are not Catholics ourselves. We are Protestants, but we still have an immense amount of respect for him, and we're very excited to see who they elect as the new pope.
And you're from Canada originally?
We're from Canada, Prince Edward Island, all the way on the East Coast, the smallest island in Canada. There are a lot of practicing Catholics, a lot of Catholic churches on Prince Edward Island, and there is a strong interest in the Pope.
And you'll stay for the first smoke signal to arise from the Sistine Chapel later on?
Yeah, we're hoping to see that. We'd love to see white smoke and be here for the announcement, but it's just really an honour to be here today and take in the festivities, and you can really see the love that people have for the newly elected Pope.
So Barry, they're hoping to see white smoke. Will you take us through the timeline? Because they probably won't get to see it if they're thinking that it's going to happen today.
Yes, well, at 3 o'clock Irish time, Claire, the Cardinals will fill the Pauline Chapel to pray to the Holy Spirit to aid them in their electoral process. Then at approximately 3:30, they will file two by two into the Sistine Chapel to the accompaniment of the Litany of Saints under Michelangelo's frescoes. At that stage, they will line up one by one behind a lectern with the gospel open and swear a solemn oath of secrecy with regards what happens in conclave. Once all that is done, the master of ceremonies will then say extra omine, everyone out, and everyone bar the 133 cardinal electors will have to leave the Sistine Chapel, which has been swept for all sorts of bugging and electronic devices to make sure nothing can get in or out. And then at around 4 o'clock, we expect the cardinals to get down to the business of voting.
Okay, so it is unlikely that we'll have a result then today, but it is expected to be a pretty quick conclave in keeping with the durations that we've seen in the recent past.
Yes, or nothing compared to the 2 years of the papal election in 1294, after which the conclave was introduced as a matter of speeding things up. The last two to select Pope Benedict in 2005 and Pope Francis in 2013 were concluded on the second day, which means there could be an expectation we may have Habemus Papam tomorrow evening, although some here in Rome saying it could go longer than that in until Friday. Remember, there are now 133 cardinal electors, more than ever before. Many are new to this process. Indeed, one quoted in Politico this morning saying several had watched the film Conclave to get an idea perhaps of what was ahead of them, whilst also one cardinal Vinko Pulagic, the Archbishop Emeritus of Sarajevo, he will cast his vote from the Casa Santa Marta guest house, which means three so-called nurses amongst the cardinals will have to go and collect his vote and perhaps bring it back. So that may well slow down the process, perhaps until Friday. And as we mentioned earlier, given the many different factions or viewpoints within the College of Cardinals, anything is still likely to happen, notwithstanding what the Holy Spirit may ultimately guide.
Barry Lenehan reporting on Today with Claire Byrne. callers to Liveline shared their memories of Weight Watchers after it was announced today that the diet company has filed for bankruptcy. Here's Antoinette.
Were you in Weight Watchers?
I was. I was in Weight Watchers for a good few years. But I remember back in 22, I was talking to a researcher earlier on, and we went one Tuesday morning down to the usual class, and the leader said, look, Weight Watchers are leaving Ireland. They'd only told them the previous Friday that they were leaving Ireland. They were going online, you know. And I remember at the time getting in touch with you and saying, like, all their meetings was what made it work for me. Getting there every week, sitting in the room, chatting, talking about different things. And that really worked for me. So I was kind of gobsmacked that they... They just pulled out of Ireland, but was all online, and it just wasn't the same after that then, you know?
It wasn't that, okay. And what was the attraction then of Weight? Because it was extraordinarily popular. What was the attraction of it? Was it a
I think it was just the buzz of going every week and finding out if you're up or you're down. Like, standing on the scale, having a good week, then going to the chipper on the way home.
And what were those meetings like? Would you be embarrassed, mortified, or over the moon be times?
All three by times, you know. Like, you might go one week and you might have been really good, and then you're up by a pound or 2 pounds and you're sitting there scarlet, like, but nobody knows. It's all private, like, you know. It's not broadcast.
Oh, is it not? Oh, I thought your weight would be called out in front of everybody.
No, if you did well, it was broadcast to the room.
Okay.
But if you didn't do well, they wouldn't home in on you, like, you know. Wouldn't be like that. And
There'd be people would share stories about what they found difficult, what they found useful, ideas they came across.
Yeah, ideas, what they might have found in the shop, how many points it might be that you wouldn't have known about it, and you might go out and get that. And then you might have the, you know, if you lost 7 pounds, you got this little silver sticker, a little silver 7 sticker. And you were jumping out over the moon, and then if you lost a stone, you were given a little glass stone, you know. So that was kind of more for your mental to keep you on track. Look at this stone and you'd see how far you'd come, you know.
And did you pay? Did you have to pay?
Yeah, you paid. It was €10 a week. But if you got to your goal, which was your own goal, if they wouldn't tell you what you needed to get to. They'd ask you what you'd be comfortable with. If you got to that, then you were free. You were a free member. You were called a gold member.
And wasn't Oprah Winfrey involved at one stage?
Yes, she was. But I only was speaking to your researcher earlier on, and she said she came off the board of directors in 2018, I think she said, or 2020. So I couldn't believe them when I heard that they were filing for bankruptcy, because they were, to me, they were, well, I was a successful member on it, Joe, but I mean, the menopause fairy put paid to that. Okay. I wouldn't be as successful as I was then.
Yeah, okay, I understand.
Yeah.
By the way, Weight Watchers was founded 61 years ago this week, in May 1963, in Queens, in New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole idea was for people to support each other.
That was really it. That's how it really started, that women got together every week. In somebody's house, by the way. It might be somebody's...
Yeah,
because I remember the story about Weight Watching, I think, watching a documentary about it, and it was just a group of women, and we'll meet, we'll have a chat about how we did, and then it'd be a different house the next week. But it was that support group that made Weight Watchers. So I was really surprised when they pulled the plug in 2022 and went online. I couldn't believe that.
And when you say online, Antoinette, are they Zoom calls or like AA and various other mindfulness groups are online? But you're all up on the screen. And you are talking to, obviously, there's lots of in-person AA meetings.
See, I don't know, because I never went that far with them. I tried to sign up, and I
Okay,
you got a newsletter, and it was something you, to me, it was something you just did on your own. You didn't have, you were never going to have the same support as you had as a, at a online as you would at a group meeting.
I know, I understand that. I totally understand it. You know? Even the chats you'd have at the end of it or beforehand.
Absolutely,
or
yeah. You make friends
the door.
Through
of course,
them, you know?
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
Jacqueline. So, stay there, Antoinette. Yeah. Jacqueline, you have a question. I don't know if I can answer it or not, but go ahead, Jacqueline.
Have I a question? No, I was just thinking, researching me just saying what Weight Watchers was like for us.
Okay, but you're saying, does anyone know why Weight Watchers pulled out of Ireland?
No.
Nobody knows.
And that's true. Nobody seems to know, even the leaders or nothing. They were just all just told that's it. Over.
That's exactly it, yeah. Our leader just told us on a Tuesday. She just said, yeah. I'm sorry to tell you, but they just told, and they only were told themselves the previous Friday, which I thought
they only told the leaders. Yeah, that was terrible. Like, they lost their jobs too, like.
Oh, did they, yeah? Oh, God, that's difficult, isn't it? And, by the way, did you pay money? Is there money owed? Did you pay money up front?
Well, I didn't.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know if anybody did, but...
Well, I presume the bit I was reading about it in the States is that they're saying the likes of Ozempic and all these new fatty chemical side effecty, everything side effects, and expensive drugs and what they call them, the skinny jabs or whatever, that they're making a difference.
Well, I don't know how they weren't around to 2022, were they? So they didn't affect Ireland.
No, they weren't around then, no.
You know,
so you're saying they're gone... They're gone longer. Yeah, they're pretty.
Yeah, they're gone longer than skinny jabs, right?
Okay, and Jacqueline and Antoinette, maybe you, Antoinette, first. Could you set up a Weight Watchers group yourselves? Do you need an organisation? Could you do it through Facebook or?
Well, the girl that ran our Weight Watchers, she set up a group after that, and as far as I know, she's still in the same place as she was with a group of people.
Okay.
Well, I know she was looking at it thinking maybe she wasn't doing so well, but she kept at it anyway. And well, I haven't been, obviously, because like it's just a lot of different things that went down that year, and I just never got going back. But as far as I know, yes, she does a group, but she obviously, it's not Weight Watchers, but you know, but she does have the motivation to give you the motivation, do you know what I mean, to carry on. And they were a lovely group of women that were in that class, but I haven't been myself, so... but I'm sure, yeah, you could. I'm sure it's quite easily done.
And I presume that was part of the success of it, was that motivation.
Yeah.
Okay, no doubt it... Well, hopefully it'll be replaced by... Because it was non-invasive. You didn't take medication. Sure you didn't, Antoinette. You didn't have to go on these concocted drinks or whatever that taste like cardboard.
No. You had a list of foods. You had a list of foods. Every food under the sun. And a weight and a 30 grams would be 1 point or 2 point. And then you were allowed, say, for your body, your size, your height, we say 20 points a day.
As heard on today's Liveline, and you can listen back to the show in full or any other show on Radio 1 on the RTE Radio app. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.